and welcome to Shelf Healing, UCL's Bibliotherapy Podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Markwick. Our guest today is Dr. Daniel Boswell. Daniel is the Programme Director of UCL's Masters in Publishing. He has a research focus in small nation cultural production, digital development and comics research. One of his master's modules is on illustration in publishing and the role of visual language design theory in semiotics. He's here today to chat all about comics.
Hi, thank you for having me.
First question we always start with, do you feel that reading is therapeutic?
Gosh, I'm trying to work out what would happen if I just said no outright to this as the opening gambit and I just countered the entire purpose of this. Well, of course, naturally, yes. As an answer to that question, I do naturally think that reading can and probably should be therapeutic. I think that some people, particularly when they're at university, you know, we're talking about academics and their engagement with this idea of books. We make it all really hard work. And I know this from talking to students this year who keep saying to me, and obviously a lot of our students on the publishing course have been English literature students. They always say, you know, when I was doing my undergrad, I read really little. We just had like our course text and I did nothing else. I really didn't enjoy it. But it's true because any kind of like organized reading is a bit like organized fun, isn't it? It kind of takes the very nature out of it. So I don't think it's particularly therapeutic when you're having to do this kind of very hard reflective practice with books, at least from my perspective. Others would disagree with that. But more importantly, given that I guess we're talking a bit about comics today, I think that the reading of comics is quintessentially therapeutic. And my own past in getting interested in comics is entirely actually kind of built around this idea of the various ways that comics have therapeutically assisted me at different points in my life. I don't mind saying that the first comic I ever had, and I always remember this, the first comic I ever had was gifted to me, as is probably the case for a lot of people, when I was ill and sent home from school one day. I think I was about 6 years old. I think this was like in like first year of primary or something. And my dad heard that I'd been sent home and came back from work early, and he'd popped into like a little kind of newsagent or something, picked up a copy of Wolverine Volume 2. It was issue 53. And it's just at the bit where Wolverine's learning about his background as part of the Weapon X program, and that he'd had his memories destroyed and taken away from him and converted into other ones. And I remember all of this really, really clearly. It really stands out. So that kind of like memory of an early illness, you know, being sent home from school, is very much connected to what I did to get through that. And it was an engrossing and wonderful read. And then I guess the more, you know, that's a really kind of on the nose example of me using comics as a recuperation technique. They definitely helped more than the tomato soup. But then later on, so as most of kind of the students on our MA know, I spent a large part of kind of my later childhood growing up in Spain. And I actually lived in Catalonia. And I went to a local village school there, and I had to learn to speak the language in order to engage in classes. But this was never done in a very kind of structured way. I was just kind of thrown into it. My parents just thought, oh, we'll just send you down to the local school. So, and I don't remember a lot of this now, but I'm often told, you know, you spent basically a month there staring out of a window, not knowing what was going on, until the teacher kind of finally called down my parents to speak with her and said, you know, he really needs to get to grips with the language. And I think we might have to try a less organic means of him getting to grips with it. My parents being who they were like, okay, what would you recommend then? So the teacher put them in touch with this language tutor that I could go to, who actually lived on a farm a few miles away from the school. And I was taken there, and I have so many memories of this whole period and that particular tutor. I remember very well. I remember that on the farm, she had various geese that used to chase me to the front door every time. So that was a traumatic experience relating to the therapy of comics. But the way eventually she realized that I was not engaging at all with the text that I was being given. And if I tried to like look at these in this other language, I had no comprehension of how to approach this or what to do. I'm only 7 years old. She realized there was no real way of encouraging me to get to grips with textbooks, school textbooks and things when they were in another language. I just wasn't focused. She did notice, though, that I seemed to be very interested in some Tintin comics that she had in the house. And through that process of her getting, first of all, me to have a look at the comics that were all in Catalan, Tintin, very broadly translated into a wide variety of European languages, wonderful thing about it. she got me, first of all, at describing what was going on in the pictures. And through this gradual process and getting me to then kind of read translations of what was in the panels and then to read the actual Catalan language panels, she gradually got me kind of engaging in this bilingual process of interpretation through the use of the comics. And the therapeutic side of that, aside from the kind of teaching, the pedagogical element to it, is that that taught me comfort with the idea of not comprehending something. Part of my difficulty in engaging with the language was that it felt so alien to me that before even being able to get to grips with the idea that I should learn this, it was just, I was scared by feeling like I'd been thrown into this alien culture that I couldn't understand. I was utterly bewildered by what was going on. And that gave me calm. It gave me peace of mind through a control mechanism in how to understand something. And that was through comics. Comics are a wonderful, wonderful teaching resource.
Definitely. I love that, learning languages through comics. I used to have a friend of mine at school who used to bring over the Asterix and Obelix comics. And I love Asterix and Obelix. I'm terrible at French. And I literally flipped through it like I was a five-year-old that could not read anything, going, I know what's happening because the art tells you what's happening, especially in Asterix and Obelix and things like Tintin, where the written words, the word bubbles, the extra text, it gives you extra. You can read it without reading it, if that makes sense. And that's all down to the hard work of the artists.
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
Translating the writer's scripts and then the colorists coloring in the artist's beautiful work, all for us to have a lovely 22-page comic to enjoy and read. And obviously you have researched comics and you have a strong love of mm-hmm. comics. And over the years, have you noticed sort of a change in how you see comics as like a thing?
That's interesting. That's an interesting question, actually. The how I've approached, how kind of my approach to my understanding of comics has changed, particularly since time when I stopped just kind of reading them as an enthusiast, like everyone, to kind of actually taking that up as an area of research, and certainly kind of a not well-represented area of research. Comic book studies, relatively kind of widely engaged with, but there's still a lot of room for discussion and expansion in the field as a discipline. Yes, I think definitely I've noticed a difference in the way that I think about comics, particularly maybe I'm kind of reflective of everybody who goes from kind of enthusiast to specialist in an area, in that I would never have, you know, in all those examples I'm talking about from childhood or even through to, you know, kind of my master's studies, which is when I really began to engage with comic book studies. I didn't engage with it in my undergrad at all. But I read a lot of comics at that stage, and we're kind of talking about the very early 2000s at this point, which was kind of a new boom point for certain types of comics following a long period of stagnation, which we can talk about if you want in a bit. But I think as an enthusiast, you just do not stop for a second to think about the production and the elements that go into the kind of the origination of the comics. What you enjoy is the end artifact, and you see that as a final completed piece, and you love it. So the things that make you kind of attracted to it and engage with it might be, yes, okay, sure, you've identified probably usually a writer, you know, usually it's the kind of the Alan Moores, the Garth Ennis's that maybe make somebody go, okay, I want to read that because I know their name and I'm familiar with their work. But above that, it's kind of just the direct aesthetic of the art that you see, the format of it, the availability of it that makes you think about it. But since I started studying comics, I'm far more interested in, I tend to find even in my just casual reading, thinking about elements like, oh, does that interest me because of the creative team that's been behind it, or how it's been released, or some aspect of the production design, circulation of the comic that makes it much more kind of fascinating to me to explore. And I think about that a lot. You mentioned, you know, at the end of the previous question we were discussing about kind of the teams, the creative teams that go into this. And I think that it shouldn't be, it should be very obvious, but I think that that's a big realization to a lot of people when you stop and reflect on the fact that one of the big things about the kind of the comic as an artifact is it really is a team that goes into the creation of it. This is a unified piece, a kind of synthetic production that's had a number of minds applied to it. I love that point. You know, there are plenty of writer illustrators out there, but the most common model for comics is at the very least between having a writer and an artist, and usually a colorist and a letterer as well. And all of those acts involve processes of translation, as you put it, in interpreting what someone else is doing and adding to that. I love that team element in the creation of art. In the same way in music, you know, all of my favorite music is produced by bands because I love people putting something together. Sure, I'm interested in the idea of one person, how that's translated, but the synthesis of it is absolutely fascinating to see. In terms of how I've kind of come to think about the production end of comics more over time, I think that was influenced by my initial kind of foray into comic book research. When I was doing my initial postgraduate studies, and I was focused on distribution platforms for comics, and I ended up doing a lot of research that at the time looked at now defunct digital platforms for the distribution of comics, ones that don't exist anymore because it turns out they didn't end up working too well. They weren't successful, but that in itself tells us something. But I was very interested at that time, and this was kind of late-ish 2000s, circa 2007, 2008, when I was interested then in the growth of what were presumably digital comics, the entrance of the comic book world into kind of the digital sphere of reading. And there were a variety of platforms, both from major publishers, you know, Marvel, DC Unlimited, which is still a kind of known one today, right through to little distribution platforms that were happening. There were the first apps for comic books like Comixology and things emerging at that point as well. And it was a really kind of fertile ground for examining, okay, what happens when a particular realm of publishing, in this case, the kind of the comic book world, tries to adapt itself to this space, which clearly, very obviously, offers so many opportunities for an expansion of the format, because digital is inherently visual. We're talking about screen access at all times. And comics, as illustrated works, as well as textual works, have a lot of kind of vested interest in the quality of that screen presentation. So I got really interested at that point in thinking about this production, how it meets what the reader does, all of those parts in kind of communication of comics that I would have never thought about before. Before, I was interested in whether I enjoyed the pictures and the various stories represented in it. And that was the summary extent of my fascination with it.
I think it's really interesting because even now, digital comics readers aren't brilliant. They're not really popular. There's a really good online manga one that does exceptionally well because manga works. I don't know whether it's because we're so used to seeing the manga art style in anime and therefore we're very used to seeing it digitally and on screen. But there seems to be a great love of physical comics, having the art that someone's put printed out that you've got and you've hold your 22-page book. Or like me, I buy them in omnibuses because they're easier for me to store. And also we're in the UK and our access to comics is less good than it is in America. You know, if I want to get the first issue of a new comic, I have to wait a month before it's here, by which point I'm like, I might as well wait for 6 months and get the omnibus of it because I'm not going to be able to engage with all of the, oh, isn't this great? Who's read this? Because I can't. It's not here. At no point do I go, oh, I'll get an online subscription and read it digitally because it feels somewhat distanced. I feel, and I don't know whether it's peculiar to comics in that we want to feel our art as opposed to see it on a screen, or whether it's the panel nature of the page that you need to see the whole page and you need to be able to see the left-hand page and the right-hand page as well as all of the panels that maybe doesn't make it work, or whether it's just me being weird and I really just like having my comics in my hand.
No, it's a very fair observation. And I mean, from a research perspective, there are certainly studies into the way that people engage with the visual dimensions of art as presented on different mediums. So thinking about this like print and digital now, and there's a lot of argument to say that generally, yeah, the public tends to have kind of an affinity for the presentation of things on origination material. So in this case, that would be the print version of the comic because that's how we understand it. But that in itself is kind of an interesting thing to think about how comic book artists and illustrators relate more broadly to generally the world of visual art, fine art. You know, we praise something painted onto a canvas when we see it in a museum with some beautiful, probably overly large frame around it. And yet, if I take a photo of that and I put it on a blog, you're still seeing the same image, but that, you know, you're not paying the ticket to view it. I mean, that's, I think there's a wider critical discussion to be had about art and our appreciation for it here, and the distrust that is created by a screen in people. I think screens create a level of reflection and representation that people kind of feel, they somehow feel detached through the screen from the original art, and it's, and therefore they distrust what they see. Oh, that's not as good quality. When you see it on paper, the colors are more lush or something. And it's all a kind of falsehood. I mean, there's not necessarily any real strong evidence to support the idea that it's quintessentially inferior or superior, but it's a perception.
It's that weird sense of intangibility on a screen. But then so many comics artists these days draw digitally with those beautiful tablets and the pens, which then means that actually, if you're drawing your art digitally, like this beautiful piece behind me, Patrick Zerker's Shumagorath, which Zoom has destroyed into just the eyeball on the central tentacles, is amazing. That's been drawn entirely digitally, which has then been printed. And then here I am saying, I want the print version rather than the digital version, when actually the digital version is going to be much closer to how Patch drew it, I imagine, in my head, which doesn't then shut up the voice going, but I want it printed on paper because I want it to be mine. But then that's part of that therapeutic nature, isn't it? Where you have it and you can go and get it whenever you want it. You know, you don't have to turn a screen on to access it. You can just go and rummage through your bookshelf and pull out, in this case, Savage Avengers, or your Wolverine comics or your Wonder Woman. You can just have them all next to each other and collect.
Yeah, I think it's another big topic to talk about, but collection is a kind of a primordial element of the comic book world. Like it's built into people's senses around it, and collection and digital. And that's an interesting thing with the platforms, thinking about something like Marvel Comics, Digital Unlimited, and what it does and how it presents those comics. People have a kind of completionist sense and a collector's sensibility when it comes to comics. And I think that the print formats, bookshelves, they play a big part in that. I think that comics are quite literally iconic, and as such, people want to use them not just as reading devices, but as icons. And a digital icon is a difficult thing to present in that sense. At the same time, like you said, you point out the irony, you know, of the majority of digital creation on illustrations now and then translating that back to print somehow, when in fact it originated there. There's also just features of the screen that personally, once, you know, you get past your kind of preconceptions, I love and adore that print just does not allow, including just reflowability and the ability to zoom in and out of sections if you're working from an app, that you can close in on panels. You can even change the reading style so that you can flip through panels on a screen and you can approach it in different ways. And I appreciate not everyone will, but I enjoy that. I enjoyed like really wanting to explore the little nuances in a background of an image and things like that. And that's what the screen does. So it's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. Sorry.
The artist has spent a whole day, you know, dotting in the background or cross-hatching or doing these complicated fancy art techniques. I'm not an artist. I do not know what they are, but I appreciate the hell out of them. And I love that. And that's brilliant. But then, like I said, that takes a whole day for maybe one panel, one page. And the problem with comics is you have 22 of those in a book, generally 22, 24 per issue. Generally, that's basically your whole month gone, drawing one page a day, which is a lot of work. And then once your book is up, that's it done, really, because most of the artists and the writers are all freelance. Even at big places like Marvel and DC, as well as the little ones, like, although Image isn't really little anymore, is it? But the little independents, the majority are freelance. So whilst we're there consuming their media,
in bulk,
writing in bulk, demanding we want more faster. Why do I have to wait a month? Draw faster, write faster. I also do often think, you know, how it's giving me comfort and joy, but is it giving them comfort and joy?
I think it's probably giving them huge amounts of stress on deadlines and things like this. You know, and it's Yeah, there's a fascinating aspect of the personality of different illustrators, and there are famous examples of what are both prolific creators of comics, people who churn stuff out really quickly, and also people who regularly go on kind of extended, you know, sabbaticals essentially from it, and people are left, you know, for a year between issues and things because they don't. And there are so many examples of series over time where people have gone, oh, it's been cancelled, and people think that's usually because of a, you know, a low number of sales thing. It's not always the case. Sometimes it's literally the production turnaround meant it was cancelled because the person just could not cope with the production schedule on this. That happens quite a lot with manga production as well. One thing on that kind of freelance work scale, and I guess this is a counterpoint to the previous thing we were discussing with the benefits of digital as well, though, is that the one thing I'll say in defense of print, I suppose it's in the defense of print, and also to clarify, you know, when we're talking about these examples, we're very much talking about the kind of the Anglo-American tradition of comic books in the kind of the Marvel DC mold, and specifically those serialized monthly issues, ones that come out regularly, and they're the ones that are produced at that length. And as you say, you can then, nowadays, a popular format is the trade paperback omnibus that then collects loads together from a period, and that's kind of a reprint of it. But the whole thing about that format, serialization, and I love serialization, that's my big defense of print here, is I enjoy reading comics in that kind of way where you get your latest monthly or weekly issue, and you read them that way. You digest them quickly. There has been a big vogue since the 2000s in the growth of long form comic book content. You know, I'm avoiding the elephant in the room here, the kind of, is it a graphic novel? Is it a comic book? But let's just say that the long form content format and presentation of comics is probably the kind of the zeitgeist today. But for me, that serial form, the kind of the magazine template, and I am a diehard fan and long-term subscriber to 2000 AD, Britain's only extant weekly comics anthology. And precisely for that reason, I love that serial format. I love receiving that comic weekly and digesting it that way, you know, like you would on a bus, because that's what it's for. From my mind, that's the distinction between that type of reading and a different type of reading. And that whole system, if you like, of distribution of production is entirely dictated by the work routine of the artists and writers on it, their pay mechanism, and the print format, because it is the necessity of the print format being economically inviable to print in that period, the amount that a producer can realistically produce for that over that period, and the internal model that the company has in funding and selling those, that all have to work together as cogs in the machine in order for comics to be produced. In much the way in the music world, you know, they say nowadays with digital streaming of music that the album format's kind of past its heyday, because that's very much reflective of needing the physical product. So why can't you just release things as you go? Well, the same is true to an extent of comics and creators, and many comics creators you've seen move over to alternative mediums like web comics and things like that. They do because it's a different working procedure for them in order to turn it around in that period. And this kind of the freelance model, 22 pages, you say, it's always interesting to me because that's changed over time, that page extent of comics. If you go back and typically read up to kind of certainly the mid-90s or so, the early 90s, most kind of Marvel and DC outputs that you see from that, typically the length was 35 pages. It's reduced over time, and it's depending on different series started doing it as well. I remember one really obvious example of this was always X-Men, because Uncanny X-Men used to come out in a 35-page format, and then X-Men and Essential X-Men used to come out at 22 pages. So it's just a weird variation that they've changed on turnarounds for them and regularity of it. But that whole system is dictated by the kind of the freelance framework.
I think it's really interesting when you're looking at sort of the freelance framework. You've got to get enough people together that you think are going to work really well. Because if you have an artist that disagrees with the writer, or a writer that disagrees with an artist, you're not going to get a particularly brilliant comic, regardless of the IP, because you could have the best writer in the world and the best artist in the world taking on something like Superman or the X-Men or Punisher, and it could be an absolutely unmitigated disaster if your writer and your artist and your letterer and your inker and your colorist all don't work well together. Because you don't get, as you said earlier, you know, you like the idea of a band, because everyone works together to create something. You have a very stagnated, well, I'll just put Swartz on this. The writer's not giving the artist any leeway. The artist isn't enjoying what's being done. I know on Twitter you often see, recently, definitely this year, a couple of big comics artists and writers have been saying, you know, how important the layout of a panel is. If the artist has left a really big space of, say, roof tiling, they're asking the writer to fill it in, to put some exposition there. And then if the writer or the letterer then puts all of the word bubbles over something that the artist has spent a long time putting detail in, you're not going to make the artist very happy. So I think there's a lot that goes into a comic that maybe, as you said, the enthusiast maybe doesn't appreciate. Or the fact that a well-drawn panel may not need any writing. And if it does have writing, that actually maybe that sentence that's been put in gives it that little extra bit of sort of pain for the reader as you read it, just to drive home everything the artist has done. And I think those are the most successful comics, you know, where the artist and the writer and the colorist and the letterer all work really well together to give you something that, unless you're into semiotics and design theory, you don't even know why you love it so much. Like the panel behind me is when you have, it's a giant panel, Shuma-Gorath, right in the middle. And then there's a tiny, tiny Doctor Strange in it. And it's a full page panel. And you look at it and it's really impressive and scary because, you know, Shuma-Gorath with his massive tentacles, it's terrifying. But Doctor Strange, you can tell that Patrick's had put a real emphasis on the position, you know, the body language of this tiny, tiny human against this gigantic elder god. And you can tell, you know, even just the swirl of the cape, that he's confident that he's got the upper hand here, you know. He's warning Shuma-Gorath about something. I don't want to give spoilers for Savage Avengers because it's great. I'm trying really hard to say it. But like the semiotics of that, he's in the bottom left-hand corner. You know, that's the corner that you look at the least. So when you look at the panel, you don't even notice he's there. And the lettering in it is in sort of very sneakily in the corners. So all you get is just Shuma-Gorath looking at you. And it's a shock because it's on a page turn, which again is something I like about comics over digital, is you don't get the feel of the page turn. Oh my goodness, it's right there in your face because you're just constantly flicking through. From a semiotics standpoint, from a researching, the colors are beautiful. It's all reds and purples and greens. And then your tiny red and blue of Doctor Strange really kind of, once you see him, he stands out really strongly. But the thing that I love is, you know, you don't see him to start off with. But it's beautifully rendered. It's lovely. Stuff like that is just what I love.
That's where it becomes a different, we're talking about a different type of reading, a different negotiation of all of the elements and how you read a comic and how you approach comics. And I think, you know, some of the best examples of the medium, the art form, show a combination of those approaches. You know, I think the most interesting thing to reflect on there is how unique each type of partnership or team working on these is. And there are a huge layer of kind of different competing viewpoints that have to be negotiated for that. Not least if you're working for one of those larger companies that kind of hold these IPs, there's the initial kind of writers' rooms debates that go into where the overarching stories go and how does each contributor in turn follow that general kind of line, those are editorial decisions. Then, like you say, there's the negotiations in artwork between the artist and the writer and then other layers to that to release it as well from coloring, et cetera. And let's not pretend that you can kind of easily generalize how these things work. I mean, every single one of those situations must be different from kind of perfect unison, you know, hybrid minds working together to people who frankly couldn't have ever been in the same room, I'm sure is the case. But I think the comics for me that have stood out most in time, you know, as being like, oh, that's a new layer to thinking about how this material is produced and presented. They blend a little bit of the best qualities from all of those. And, you know, they have long swathes, passages of content that require no signaling on the part of the writer. And yet they'll also have passages where the script is also very crucial and important. And I think that's vital as well. You know, I wouldn't devalue either the illustrator or the writer's kind of contributions to narrating that story. Like you say, it's the translation point, the point at which those come together and work with one another, that things happen fantastically. I mean, to quote a really like standard commonplace example of this, but a comic that that does it really well and shows all of these elements. And that's, like, I would argue one of the reasons why it's kind of become so kind of embedded within Western canon, even if the author is not necessarily at the top of his popularity today. But thinking about Alan Moore's Watchmen, produced with Dave Gibbons, the balance of these elements in that serial work very effectively, because there are lots of landscape montages used to present shifts in time, shifts in mood. If you actually go through that comic and kind of quantify the level of script versus the layers of content and presentation, and also bits that you wouldn't be able to understand from the script without visually seeing, you know, bits about like Rorschach and the representation of it. There's a lot of kind of anti-syzygy, a lot of misrepresentation of ideas that goes from the script, where the picture kind of deceives you into that. And that's important. But the thing that Moore does a lot with his scripts as well, and you'll see this kind of across the writing, is that he does a lot of scene setting. And if you remove the illustrated parts of comics for a second and think about what they are, which is essentially like play scripts, but play scripts have both of the kind of the cast narration, the acts, the characters in them, and they also have little scene setting points to tell you what's going on, narrations around that. And Moore uses those really effectively in his writing. And I think that in turn gives artists working with him room to kind of maneuver and think, oh, how do I represent these little bits of direction that I've got? I just think that the Gibbons' work as an illustrator in Watchmen is absolutely gorgeous. And a lot of people disagree with me about that, because it's very like linear, clear and precise, but I love it. It's like a film reel watched in slow that you can take. It's great.
I think that's also worth picking up, the different styles of artists, because I think the reason why comic books work so well as comfort reads for so many people is the fact that there are so many different styles. So I like quite realistic, well-drawn. I love the hyper detail because I can lose myself in it. And often when I'm reading a comic book, I want to lose myself. I want to disappear somewhere. I love inkblot, because whoever thought the cat should literally just be one shade of black with eyeballs was a genius, because I probably would have gone, you need to colour in all the fur. But the fact that he's literally just a blob, I love it. I mean, it's a cat-shaped blob. In it, whoever's made the decision there, because the rest is nicely detailed. You know, it's not, the whole thing isn't just very stylized. It is literally just inkblot who is stylized. Everything else is beautiful. But whether that was an artist decision or a writer decision or an editorial decision, I don't know. But just perfection, I think, there in just, because you don't know what it is, because it's making portals. Who is it? What is it? Just genius. But that stylized thing, there's lots of the more cartoony styles, the more sort of Asian influenced manga type styles coming through in certain areas, as well as that kids comic feel, you know, the very round faces, as well as just, if you look at some of the work that Jimmy Palmiotti does at the minute, that sort of quite stylized drawings. There's something for everyone, I think. If you're looking at comics as well-being, there's a lot of bases covered.
I think the comics market, I can't even say the comics market, because that implies a very kind of manifold thing, but comics markets right now are suitably, from my tastes, they're suitably diverse, and there is, for those who realize where to go to find them, there is enough choice there for everyone. That's often been the case. You know, underground comics have always been a counter in some way to the kind of the more mainstream comics. But I think that there's a plurality of choice today, which is really nice and allows people from all kinds of backgrounds and levels of interest to get into. There is that stereotype of comics are for kids that we all kind of at some stage might have heard somebody kind of say something along those lines. And the reality is there's nothing in the term that should indicate that, and any more than you say, you know, novels are for kids. It's just a generic term for a medium and a format. And within that, I have no doubt that there are some comics which are very suitable for kids and great, and I encourage kids to read. And then there are plenty that are for all reading and age groups, you know, and in part that's dictated by a wide variety of source content and material. Now, within that, we have the kind of the more obvious and immediate understandings of this. When we say comics, you know, in a discussion like this, we've been making a lot of assumptions every time we say comics, that we're referring very specifically to Anglo-American comics, kind of Marvel DC style. Within that, we're referring to capes literature. We're talking about superhero comics here, you know, and there's plenty that goes beyond this. And it even relates in a kind of really meta way today to these things. You know, I love the fact that the world of Archie has been embedded into the wider DC world now, so you can get him alongside Superman and stuff. But I think that there's a very mature market for comic book literature today. And I think that that's a really fantastic thing. I think, like you're pointing out as well, some of the mainstream, because it's always been there a bit in the underground, but some of the mainstream has opened up much more to global tastes within that as well now, where you do see a lot more direct influence of great manga artists and things in forthcoming. And also crossover from that, you know, people who are manga artists getting invited to do guest series on Anglo-American comics, some American writers coming and, you know, guest featuring on European releases. You've got them coming and producing new manga series of the X-Men and things like that. You know, you've got all these lovely little bits of crossover that acknowledge different styles, but also inform one another. And that's great. That's really cool.
That's the end of part one of our chat with Dr. Daniel Boswell, a comics researcher all about the joyful, wonderful world of comics. And we will be back next week, not with Daniel, but with a lovely, lovely Spanish publisher called Jordi. And then we'll have Daniel the following week. So just have to keep this comics business going on forever and ever. I love it. Thanks, as always, to Nicholas Patrick for our music. Share this with your friends, anyone you think would enjoy it. Give us a like on Twitter, @shelf_healing. And if you fancy it, drop us a review. We love reviews. Always love to hear what you think of the show.